From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Last December, Texas lawmakers passed Senate Bill 4, one of the most extreme pieces of anti-immigrant legislation any state legislature has ever enacted. Under SB 4, local and state law enforcement can arrest people they suspect to have entered Texas without federal authorization. It also permits Texas judges, who are not trained in immigration law, to order the deportation of migrants to ports of entry along Texas's border with Mexico, regardless of which country they are from. On top of all of this, police may charge individuals with a new state crime of illegal entry or illegal re-entry and refusal to comply with deportation orders, with some charges punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Since SB 4 passed, a whirlwind of court orders have blocked it from going into effect, allowed it to be reinforced for several hours, and then blocked it again, stoking mass confusion. States do not have the constitutional authority to deport people, and an unconstitutional law like SB 4 only imposes added threats to migrants' livelihoods and path to asylum. Here to give us the latest news on SB 4 and our fight against it is David Donati, senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Texas working on immigration. David, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so David, SB 4 is all over the legal map. I want to talk about its current state in just a second. But first, can you explain what the bill entails and where it came from?
Sure. So Texas Senate Bill 4 is a law passed by the Texas legislature during the fourth special legislative session. Our governor, Greg Abbott, just has the ability to reconvene the legislature if and when he so chooses. And this legislative session was actually to pass school voucher programs as a gift to certain political donors. But when it became quite clear that that wasn't going to happen, they resorted to the partisan red meat of immigration restrictions. And so even though SB 4 and bills like it had died in the regular legislative session and the following special legislative sessions, during the fourth special, we got one of the most extreme anti-immigrant pieces of legislation that I've ever seen in the United States. And Senate Bill 4 does a few things, and it does a few things very intentionally. And we saw this playing out in the legislature, where the state wanted to regulate immigration. It wanted to incarcerate immigrants. But our legislators said that that didn't go far enough, that incarcerating people is expensive. And so it's not enough to just impose these dramatic sentences on non-citizens. The state also wanted to, and according to many lawmakers, including the proponents of the bill, needed to take the extra step of deportation. Mm-hmm. And because the state of Texas has no experience in or authority to carry out deportations, the only thing they could think to do is just take people to Mexico. And even though a solid majority of people who are entering Texas between ports of entry are not Mexican nationals, even though a solid majority of them are families, the way that SB 4 operates is you are arrested for these suspected crimes. And from your very first appearance in front of a magistrate, there is a risk that you will then be deported into Mexico, whether or not Mexico is willing to accept you. And if you do not comply, then you can be sentenced to up to 20 years in prison.
Wow, it's extremely punitive. So does this mean that any undocumented person in Texas could be arrested?
More than that, I think it means any person in Texas could be arrested for suspected illegal entry or reentry. But the short answer to your question is yes, because you have the illegal entry provisions, which are suspected entry between ports of entry. But then there's the illegal reentry provision, and those sweep even broader than the illegal entry provisions. The illegal entry provisions have a couple of affirmative defenses. You can't be prosecuted if you have a defense to the federal equivalent of it. Illegal reentry doesn't have anything like that. And so it's very possible that people who are here with the permission of the federal government to be here under specific forms of immigration relief are still violating the state illegal reentry provision and are still liable for prosecution under that provision. And just adding to that, the state counts its own deportations as a removal for its own purposes. And so if you are kicked out by Texas unlawfully and you're at any point found in the state thereafter, then you are potentially liable for illegal reentry. Mm. It is a really dramatic and sweeping law that creates a lot of fear for people, regardless of their immigration status.
Right. I can only imagine that this opens up the opportunity for racial profiling to happen as well.
Without a doubt. I mean, we have a lot of experience in Texas with racially disparate impacts of policing, prosecution, and incarceration. This is not something that is new to us. But when you make the crime something that's based on identity itself, which SB4 does, the only thing that SB4 turns on is, who are you and what kind of status do you have as a human being? And for us, I'm in Houston. Houston is an incredibly diverse place. And I think for a lot of us, the question is, well, do we seem like we belong? And it's not a question that we're answering with regard to our community. You know, when I go to the Sugarland Community Center, everybody is like me, an immigrant or the child of immigrants. The question is, will that law enforcement officer consider me to be someone who belongs? Do I fit the sort of picture of an American? And I think that that is a real concern for people, regardless of what your status is. I don't leave my house with my passport, and most people don't, and they shouldn't have to. But there is that very real fear that, hey, if I'm driving, if I have an accent, if my skin color is darker than an Anglo-American, will I be perceived as someone who doesn't belong? And what kind of exposure does that create for me?
Yeah, this really seems to be such a broad, sweeping piece of legislation that allows the state authority to really kind of, for lack of a better word, terrorize communities. What will happen to folks who are perhaps in mixed status families, to families at large?
It's a terrifying situation. And we get a lot of these questions because SB4 does not exist in a vacuum. It exists in a system of state policing and laws. And so one of the questions that we get all the time is, Texas has a very broad human smuggling statute. So it is a crime in Texas to conceal someone, including people who are undocumented. And the Texas law goes even further. It says it's a crime to induce or encourage someone to be in the United States without lawful status. And so what does it mean to encourage or induce someone to be here? And that's a fear that we actually hear quite a lot from our communities. If I'm driving my grandmother to the doctor's office, if I'm housing someone, my cousin, in my spare bedroom, is that an inducement to remain in the country? And in addition to SB4, we got 10-year mandatory minimum sentences for human smuggling in Texas. And so we're hearing a lot of that concern of, well, my family is mixed status, and we have a large percentage of children in Texas live in mixed status families. And we know from experience that deportation very much separates families. Because we haven't regularized our immigration system in decades, we have grandparents here who are undocumented. They have U.S. citizen children, grandchildren, the livelihoods, the patriarchs, the matriarchs of their families and communities. They've not committed a single crime. And it is a state of perpetual fear and exclusion. And so it's just something that I think affects all of us. And the only difference is whether we acknowledge that it affects us and how close to our hearts we feel it.
Oh, that's such a good point, David. The idea that this does impact everyone, and especially everyone in the state of Texas, because of the folks that have been in your communities for such a long time. What if someone is coming from another state into Texas?
I think that's a very real concern. The way that I parse the law is a little bit particular, but I do want to point out that we had an argument in front of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals 2 weeks ago, and the Solicitor General of the state of Texas, the state's top appellate lawyer, was asked this question by the Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit. And his answer was, well, I don't know. And I think the point to emphasize is that it is such a complex situation because everybody's situation is very different. And that's part of the problem with Texas's approach here and part of the necessity of the United States speaking with one voice on this issue, having a system in place that is passed by Congress and enforced by a single agency with regulations and coherence and structure and supervisory responsibility. In Texas, you don't have that. Under SB 4, you don't have that. In Texas, we have over 2,700 law enforcement entities.
Wow.
All of which are empowered to enforce SB 4. It's just any peace officer in the state. All of whom are empowered to set their own priorities, to exercise their own discretion. And that's to say nothing of the individual officers. And one of the really sinister pieces of SB 4 is that in addition to creating these criminal penalties, it also does what's called indemnification. And so if you are a peace officer, either a member of the Department of Public Safety or any of these other 2,782 agencies, and you violate civil or constitutional rights in the process of executing SB 4, oftentimes you can be liable for damages. You know, you harm a family, you pull over a vehicle aggressively, they're U.S. citizens, you had no basis for the stop, you cause injury. Under SB 4, you actually can't hold those individual law enforcement officers accountable. It's like qualified immunity supercharged. And so these are systemic things that are built into the law, which substantially increase the amount of danger that people are going to feel in their day-to-day lives.
So it's not just giving broad authority to state parties, state individuals to act on their own volition, in many ways. It's also granting them immunity to be not held liable for their actions if they are damaging. The last circumstance I want to talk about is about folks who will be removed from Texas, who will be taken to the border in Mexico. What happens in a situation like this? Folks who aren't Mexican nationals being taken into Mexico.
This is one of the big question marks. And the honest answer is, I don't know. And unfortunately, Texas doesn't know either. And we've never seen anything like it. So according to the sort of chief law enforcement agent who submitted a declaration in our case, the idea is that a person is going to be escorted by a law enforcement officer, usually a part of the state's main law enforcement agency, the Department of Public Safety, to the port of entry, and they're going to be ordered to go across into Mexico. And then what happens there is just not contemplated by the law. I think that there are two things that are really complicated after that moment. One of them is Mexico has said that they are not going to accept Texas deportations. There are good reasons for that. They're a sovereign country as well. And so I think Mexico is looking at this from the same perspective of, we are international sovereigns, and this is a really important part of our function. So what Mexico does is a big question mark. And if you're a Venezuelan national, if you're a Haitian, if you're from Nigeria, and we have people who are entering Texas from well over 100 countries all over the world, right? So it's really not an obvious situation. Many of them cannot go back to their home country because this is the nature of asylum.
Right.
You're here because you cannot survive in the place where you were born. But then the other big question mark is, so let's say Mexico doesn't accept somebody. Mexico says, okay, well, we're not letting you into Mexico, go back into the United States. If those people are again apprehended, they could be charged with illegal reentry. They could be charged with refusal to comply with the removal order. And that is up to 20 years of incarceration. So it is truly a harrowing circumstance for those people who are just caught between two countries with no ability to go back to their home nation. And it's something that we've never seen before.
It's just unbelievably inhumane to put people in this situation, to have nowhere to go, and then to be punished for the fact that they have nowhere to go, let alone denying them potentially of their constitutional right to have their asylum claims heard. That is another layer of this. I want to move into talking about the legal battle and this kind of back and forth that we've seen. SB4 is currently temporarily blocked by a federal appeals court, but that is only until the Fifth Circuit Court hears arguments, which were, as of this episode airing, were heard just yesterday. The ACLU, ACLU of Texas, and the Texas Civil Rights Project filed a lawsuit on behalf of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, American Gateways, and El Paso County, arguing that SB4 is unconstitutional. What is the basis of your claim that it is unconstitutional?
So we're representing El Paso County, which is a true border community, and they've always thought of themselves as such. And they're responsible for the people who live in their community, to keep them safe, to keep families together, for the economic viability of the community, as well as two organizations, Las Americas and American Gateways. So they are, I think, the real short of it, people who participate in the federal immigration system on behalf of precisely the people who will be impacted by SB4. And our claim is really simple. It is essentially that for 150 years, for as long as immigration has been regulated at all in the United States, it has been exclusively the prerogative of the federal government. There is a supremacy clause in the Constitution, and it commands that the Constitution, laws, and treaties of the United States are supreme, and everything that the states and local governments do that violates that is void. And it really should be an open and shut case, just because we do have 15 decades of clear and decisive Supreme Court and other court statements to that effect.
Let alone the inhumanity of it all, it's great that we have the ability to make super powerful legal argument that has, as you mentioned, decades of precedent to support it. So we are recording this a couple of days before you all head to court on April 3rd. That's in 2 days from now. David, what do you expect to see and hear in the oral arguments before the court? What are you preparing for?
We are in one of the most unusual procedural postures that I've ever been in. And I think a lot of people probably would echo that. We had an argument in front of the federal district court in Austin. And a federal district judge agreed with us, agreed with our plaintiffs, and said SB4 is clearly unconstitutional. What's very complicated about this procedural posture is that those three judges who ruled against Texas and in our favor, they were ruling on what's called a stay. And so we want an injunction. The Court of Appeals can stay that injunction, basically undoing it. The Fifth Circuit said, no, we're not going to give you that. We're not going to undo the injunction. But they still have to hear the substance of the district court's decision on the preliminary injunction. So that's what we're in court for on April 3rd. It's the substance of the preliminary injunction. In consequence and in effect, it's pretty similar to what we've already argued. We have the same three judges, which is the chief judge of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, as well as two others. So they've already ruled in our favor and against Texas. It would be somewhat surprising for them to change their perspective, but we are in a slightly different procedural posture. So anything is possible, and we don't take anything for granted.
Wow. You guys have been through a lot. And I often think that when we see this kind of procedural confusion, this like broad-based law confusion, all of it seems a little bit intentional. This piece of legislation and this legal battle comes at a time when Texas is already in two other major court battles with the Department of Justice over the state's use of razor wire and floating buoys along the border designed to block migrants from entry. You're on the ground in Texas. You're steeped in this every day, as you just laid out for us. The state of Texas is now weathering record high numbers of migrants coming to the border. And they say the administration isn't doing enough. That's their argument. How do you react to that?
Number one, I disagree with the fundamental premise. And I think I disagree with it on a couple of different levels. The first is the really foundational issue of like, well, is there too much migration and what can we do with it? I understand that that's a really hard question. And I also think it's a really important conversation that we have to have and that we do have all the time. I think you can go back that 150 years of Supreme Court precedent saying that the federal government's supreme at every single one of those junctures. You had a disagreement about migration. But what I would say about today is that we don't have an immigration crisis. We have a management crisis. Because what every economist will tell you, what every person who's looking at the U.S. labor market will tell you is, oh, hold on, immigration is actually good. We actually need immigration. And I will be the first to tell you our systems are outdated and broken and they're not designed to meet the moment. They're not. So I will grant that point. But the fundamental we have too many people coming is one that I will always push back on, especially as a child of immigrants myself and as a person who's lived in immigrant communities my entire life. Like, this is what America is to me. The second piece of it is the federal government not doing enough. I think the federal government is doing a whole lot. And if you look at deportation numbers, the Biden administration deported more people in the last 8 months of 2023 than any other administration had done in the years prior. The Biden administration continues to spend more money, we're talking $20+ billion a year, on border security and enforcement. And that is several times more than we were spending even in the early 2000s after September 11th. And the problem is that there is no amount of enforcement that will prevent people from trying to survive. There's just no amount of enforcement. There's no amount of punitive deterrence first policy that will answer people's fundamental need. It's that old quote, nobody puts their child in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. And that's just the reality with all the people that we talk to.
Yeah, it really does seem both that the narrative is old, stale, and tired based on how you just traced our history of this narrative of stoking fear about migrants coming to the United States. I think it's really important at this time to emphasize that, you know, regardless of whether or not SB 4 goes into effect or whatever happens after April 3rd, that people know their rights concerning this law, yes, but also just their rights in general. So, David, if we could do kind of a brief primer on what folks in Texas on the ground should know, what would we want to tell them?
I'm going to stick to the sort of ACLU parts of it, because we're civil rights lawyers, we're not immigration lawyers. But I'll just get the immigration parts of it out of the way quickly, which is, you know, if you are a member of a mixed status family, if you are undocumented yourself, it is really important to have a plan. And it's helpful to have an immigration attorney, but there are also forms available online that I would encourage folks to check out and just to think through those plans, because it's really stressful and it's frustrating that people have to think, well, what if I'm just pulled over for speeding and then all of a sudden the life that I've built is completely derailed? But I do think nonetheless, it's a little bit less scary if you have a plan, if you are able to deal with those contingencies. From the ACLU perspective, really importantly, the Constitution is the law of the land. We have a Texas Constitution that has similar points in it, and it is supreme. So the Supreme Court has said very clearly that whether or not you are a citizen, you are entitled to constitutional protections, and for a really simple reason, that the Constitution protects, quote, any person, and we are all people. So regardless of your status, you have rights. What are the most important ones? I would say the Fourth Amendment right to security in our persons and effects. That means that if a law enforcement officer wants to search us, wants to enter into our home, our office, any kind of private building, or access our private materials, we have the right to say no. They may have a warrant, and what I would say is honor those warrants, never interfere with law enforcement. But if they say, can I search your car? If they say, can I come into your home? You have the right to say no or to ask them for a warrant. Whether or not they listen is a separate question. The other really important part is we have the right to remain silent. That's the Fifth Amendment. And so you don't have to answer any questions about where you were born, what your immigration status is. You have the right to say, am I free to go, officer? And if not, you have the right to demand an attorney and say, I'm not answering any questions without an attorney. In Texas, we do have mandatory identification laws. They're not superior to the Fifth Amendment, but the identification laws are pretty simple. If you are lawfully arrested, either for committing a crime or if a law enforcement officer thinks you're a witness, you do have to provide your name, residence address, and date of birth, but that's it. And none of that is where were you born, what's your immigration status, name, residence address, date of birth. And I think those are the critical ones for people to just know.
David, thank you so much for walking us through that. It's really important to have this information ahead of time so that we can make informed decisions. But, you know, I think it's worth saying here that that information is so not widely disseminated and certainly not usually made accessible in multiple languages. And I think that that piece of it is really heartbreaking because I think, you know, everyone deserves to and should know their rights so that they can keep themselves safe. As we await these forthcoming decisions on SB4, and we continue to see this narrative of increased migration come into play in our political discourse, what can we say to folks who are listening who might want to support, even if they're not directly impacted or would not be directly impacted by SB4?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what can people do to support? You know, a lot of it is understand who you are and where you're coming from, what your exposure is to a law like SB4, because we are all affected, but also what this looks like for your community. Because immigration is, like reproductive justice, just something that we don't talk about all that much. With immigration, similarly, we have created this environment where it is unacceptable to talk about your story. You know, I came here without papers because I needed to. And understanding that all of us, regardless of whether it's something that we recognize, acknowledge, are touched by immigration in one way or another. And this shapes so many aspects of our lives. And I think just that kind of cross-cultural communication and understanding will go a long way. And we can also protect each other. Not necessarily because everyone's going to be able to give a speech like I just did about here's what you do with the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, but I can tell you, ACLUTX.org, we have Know Your Rights information. And so if you think that there are people in your community, and I'm not just talking about undocumented people, I'm talking about your kids who are learning to drive. If you think that there are people in your community who would benefit from knowing, this is a plan. And it's not just remain silent. It's also don't lie to police. Don't run away. Don't force them or obstruct them. These are just good things that can help keep us safe. They're important conversations that we don't want to have because they're scary and because they sort of acknowledge the danger that we can be in. But I think it's always better to have a plan. And that's something that all of us can and should be doing.
All really important points. David, when you were talking about the fact that this has existed since the beginning of our country and will continue to exist long after this particular moment with SB4 in Texas, it reminded me of that amazing MLK quote, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And I think ultimately we have to have that staying power to weather all of these mini storms and major storms that will come our way with regards to immigration specifically and regards to our rights more broadly. And we're just so grateful that we have you and the other folks at the ACLU of Texas fighting the good fight. Thank you so much for your time and good luck on Wednesday.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to At Liberty wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. Two special notes before we close. Are you a high school student fighting to make a difference in your community? Or do you know a high school student that is a change maker? The ACLU is working with young people ages 15 to 18 from across the country for our annual National Advocacy Institute, an in-person event for high schoolers taking place in Washington, D.C. from July 21st through the 27th. The Institute will feature workshops and seminars from top-level experts, trainings on how to get involved and how to build impactful advocacy campaigns, all culminating in a collective day of action on Capitol Hill. Financial aid is available for students who qualify, including round-trip travel stipends. Space for this year, 2024, is filling up fast. Head over to aclu.org/institute now to learn more and sign up. And from our colleagues at the ACLU of South Carolina, While I Breathe is a new podcast about people fighting to defend and advance civil liberties in South Carolina. It features in-depth conversations with local activists and experts, starting with a multi-part series on housing justice issues in the national capital of evictions. While I Breathe is available wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check it out. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Genesis McPio is our intern.